is really my great pleasure to be able to introduce the keynote speaker today, my good friend, Professor Declan Murphy. Pardon me, I have to read this next bit. It wouldn't be possible otherwise. Dr. Murphy is the Mortimer D. Sackler Professor of Translational Neurodevelopment and Director of the Sackler Institute of Translational Neurodevelopment at the Institute of Psychiatry, King's College London. He's also the head of the Department of Forensic and Neurodevelopmental Sciences and the director of the Behavioral and Developmental Psychiatry Clinical Academic Group, King's Health Partners, King's College London. He completed his undergraduate training in medicine at the University College London and his postgraduate training in psychiatry at the Maudsley Hospital and Institute of Psychiatry. His research training was first at the Institute of Psychiatry and then at the NIH. He returned from the NIH to the UK in order to establish a translational research program in neurodevelopment. Together with his colleagues in Oxford and Cambridge, Professor Murphy established the MRC UK Ames Multicenter Imaging Network to study brain imaging and autism. And he leads a National Institute for Health Research funded program on the health and service needs of individuals with autism as they transition from childhood to adulthood. His keynote this morning will build on his experience leading the European Union Innovative Medicine Initiative in Autism, truly a remarkable initiative, as you'll hear. It's a novel collaboration between Autism Speaks, 14 European academic centers and industry who have come together to develop the infrastructure for the discovery of new treatments in autism. So who better than Professor Murphy to tell us about why there are so few effective treatments for autism and can translational neuroscience help? Please welcome Professor Murphy.
So a very special welcome to everybody, and a very, very special welcome to the people who Joe has particularly asked me to talk to today, and that's people who are graduate students and students and people attending in FAR for amongst the first time. So how many students and graduate students have we got in the audience? Welcome to you all, the future. I apologize immediately before I carry on for those of you at the back who can't see me. There's an obvious reason for that, okay? And translational neuroscience unfortunately can't help with that. All of the work that I'm going to talk to you about today in the last part of this talk, I want to be very clear, is not only my work, it's not my work at all, it's the work of all my colleagues who I'm proud to work with and who I learned so much from. My colleagues at the Institute of Psychiatry in Cambridge and at Birkbeck, but also my colleagues within EU Ames. And I'll be telling you more about EU Ames at the very end of this talk. So my talk today is going to be split into four sections. You can fall asleep at the end of each one, don't worry, because I'll give you reminders as we go through kind of what the key messages are, all right? So what I'm going to firstly do is say, well, you know, what's the current situation? What treatments have we currently got for autism? What progress can we make in the short term? And then I'm going to say, well, we need to have a dual-track approach. We need to think short term, but we also need to think about much longer-term solutions. And what are the barriers to those long-term solutions? I'll then tell you what the current solutions are, what we've thought about within the United States of America and within Europe. And then at the very end, I'll say, well, you know, sounds okay, but it's not good enough. We need to make actually better progress than that. So where are we at in the current situation? Now, I'm assuming, perhaps this is my bias, but there's a very large amount of psychologists in the room. Is that right? Hold up your hand if you're a psychologist. Fantastic. Proud to be a psychologist. How effective do you think your treatments are currently? Right? Actually, I think that there's a good evidence base that some psychological treatments are effective. But the problems are that we don't know who those psychological treatments and educational interventions are going to work in. So you have an awful lot of people entering into treatment trials and or treatment programs who you don't know if they're going to respond or not. And there's a terrific, terrific talk. I mean, I obviously hate to blow up, you know, and inflate the ego of other people. But there's a wonderful talk by David Mandel online from the Autism Science Foundation. I urge you to go and look at that. And what he's saying there is why it's so difficult to translate behavioral approaches into real life situations. So that's where we're at with psychological treatment. In terms of pharmacological treatments, which is what Joe asked me to talk about today, clearly because I knew I'd be talking to such an august and intelligent audience, I spent months and months poring over the research literature around the clinical trials. And I've drawn up a list of what I think the evidence suggests are effective pharmacological interventions for core symptoms. So let me just check that is the right slide. Yep, that is the right slide, okay? My bias is that for treatment of the core symptoms, we have no reasonably good or very good pharmacological agents that we can use. So where are we at, and how can we make progress? Well, I think we can actually make very rapid progress by doing the obvious and doing what we were trained to do. And that is to diagnose people better and quicker, but also to realize that individuals with autism also have a very large amount of associated symptomatologies. These can be, for example, ADHD. They can also be anxiety and depression. And we know that the associated symptoms are amongst the biggest drivers of the healthcare burden. So how are we doing then currently in the United Kingdom and internationally in terms of diagnosing people and treating those associated symptoms? Well, we looked within the UK and we said within a primary healthcare setting, how are we doing? All those individuals in the primary healthcare setting who had been diagnosed as having an autism across the UK, the average age of diagnosis of autism was about 10 years, approximately. Now, you may be thinking, goodness me, that's terrible in England, isn't it? I think that too, but, you know, how are you doing in your countries? I'm a naturally competitive person, right? So we've got this relatively late age of diagnosis. But we're also seeing that in this primary healthcare setting, about a third of those people are getting prescribed medications, right? But of those third, we're seeing that a third are getting more than two medications. So I hear you gasp, what are those medications? And how is it varying internationally? Well, for those of you who think that psychiatrists and general practitioners are sensible people, and we do things in the same way, we don't. This shows you the massive prescribing variation to people with autism under the age of 19 across the world. So you'll see, for example, within the United Kingdom, we have a relatively high usage of antidepressants, but our major prescriptions are around medications for ADHD. In contrast, in other countries, if you're beneath 19, you're highly likely to be prescribed an antipsychotic. How are we doing over 19? Again, huge international variations in what we're prescribing to individuals with an autistic spectrum disorder. So unless we think that there is such a massive difference internationally in the clinical phenotype of autistic spectrum disorder, that suggests that we as clinicians can do better in terms of our own diagnosing and our own prescribing. So before I get on to, you know, how can we get new treatments of the long term, the sexy stuff about working with rodent models, etc., I'm going to say, you know, we can make a difference right now. You can make a difference right now. And you can make that difference by diagnosing quicker and better, You can make that difference by targeting those associated symptoms. And you can make that difference if you're a young researcher by helping develop standard operating procedures and the evidence base for those interventions for the associated symptoms. And also, of course, it goes without doubt that we need to work across the lifespan. It's a lifespan disorder. We cannot just have treatments that are aiming at one particular group of individuals with an autistic spectrum disorder. So that's the short term. How are we doing in the long term? Well, in terms of doing for the long term, maybe one of the things that we have to do is to learn from what's going on in other disorders and how we can make progress. So let's just do that first of all, before we get on to what's happening within autism. So let's take two comparator diseases. They're both highly genetic, with an environmental input, cardiac disease and cancer. So how are they diagnosed? They're diagnosed by a combination of history and biomarkers and special investigations. They do not just rely upon clinical history. They have treatment protocols which use a combination of medications and behavioral interventions. You would never expect, if you have cardiac disease, that you would just get a medication or probably just one medication. You would anticipate that you would have a holistic approach to your cardiac problems, which would include diet, behavioral modification, etc. But yet within autism, we're kind of different. We diagnose just using clinical history. And often our treatment modalities that we think about because of the way we work is maybe down one line, not combination treatments. What else goes on in these other diseases? These other diseases, they carry out clinical trials in which they embrace the heterogeneity of the individuals in that trial. They try and stratify within that trial to different subtypes of, say, cancer or subtypes of cardiac disease, and they aim interventions based at those different subtypes. And when they do their treatment trial, they use objective measures. That might be a biomarker or it might be something else, but it's an objective measure. They don't say, following the treatment trial, Mary, is your friend Bob or your child John feeling better? They measure what's going on in John or Bob or Mary. And that's very different than what we're doing. The other difference is that, at least within those other disorders, the community is very engaged in their treatment trials. Individuals want those clinical trials. So who here is involved in clinical trials? Fantastic. Who here can name me a clinical trial in autism with more than 300 people in? Fantastic. 400 people. 500 people? 500 people. 600 people. Okay. So we've 600, 700? Okay. So we're going to get to about 1,000 maybe, approximately. Okay. So let's just see how we do as compared to other disorders. 162,423 men in Europe went under an appalling procedure to decide whether they had prostate cancer or not. Now, no matter what you think about us European men, I can guarantee you, A, we didn't deserve it, and B, none of us really wanted to do that. But 162,000 people. We walk backwards now. 127,746 men trial for bowel cancer. And so it goes on. So where does autism fit into that? I would say that we do not have trials on the scale of these other disorders, which allow us to begin to fractionate our phenotypes to ask questions of biologically meaningful subgroups, or even behaviorally meaningful subgroups, or cognitively meaningful subgroups. So how are we going to make progress then? Well, I think that we can make progress, and I'm going to give you just one model of how we can make progress. This isn't the only model, it's not the only way to think, but let's just go with this for a second and see how far we get. So let's say, what do we know about autism that might be able to help us design new treatments? Well, we know that autism is associated with differences in many, many genes, maybe thousands of genes. But we know that of those genes, you know, they only account for about 1% of cases. Despite that, we know that, the most frequent genes account for 1% of cases. We know that synaptic genes are implicated in a proportion. And we know also that from CNVs and rare copy number variants, they don't explain the heritability and familial risk, but they may well have a significant role within autism, and particularly for us understanding mechanisms which might underpin clinical symptoms. So this is the kind of current way that people are thinking, and I thank Dan Geschwin for lending me this slide. So we think we have all these genes on the far left as you look at your poster up there. We then think that these genes work along particular molecular pathways. We think that these molecular pathways then impact on biological pathways. And we think that they then impact on brain regions and circuits, and that you then end up with autism. That's the kind of thinking at the moment. But you see, what that thinking means is that if there are hundreds and hundreds of genes involved, we've got to be thinking potentially of hundreds and hundreds of molecular pathways. What's a way to try and pass that down to a way that we can make traction? Well, one of the ways, and exemplified by the work of Dan and colleagues of mine at the Institute of Psychiatry, is to try and look for final common pathways, to look for fewer final roads that all those avenues lead into. And in this particular example that Dan published, they showed the potential importance of the molecular pathology within some synaptic signaling from synaptic development and also some GABAergic markers. And I'm now going to spend a little bit of time on glutamate and GABA, and then I'm going to come back. So, what are glutamate and GABA, and why are we so interested in them? Well, in your brain, you have this thing called excitatory-inhibitory balance. And as you can see from these two kids on the swing, the way it tilts depends upon how much input you get on either side. So if you were having too much excitation or too much inhibition. The idea is you want to maintain balance. And currently, there's some evidence that people with autism might have abnormalities in this excitatory-inhibitory balance. And people have been focusing initially around the right-hand side of that slide that you see called glutamate. That's the kind of excitatory bit. Others, however, have been saying, well, let's look at the other side of the equation and let's look at GABA. And some of the first work was done in monogenic mice, in other words, mice who've got a particular genetic lesion, which we think might be informative. And there was a really wonderful study that was carried out by Han and colleagues in 2012, in which they showed that a mouse model of Dravet syndrome, which has very many autistic-like features within it, responded to treatments targeting the GABA receptor, and a particular subtype of GABA receptor. That group then said, well, okay, that's in these monogenic forms. Does that really translate out to more rodent models that might be more like normal, inverted commas, autism, more idiopathic autism? So they chose to study the BTBR mouse. And what they found there was significant evidence that this mouse had differences in the electrophysiology in its brain relating to excitation and inhibition. They also found that that rodent had some autistic-like behaviors which responded to treatments targeting that receptor subtype. And then Han and colleagues went one step further. They said, well, okay, what happens if in a mouse, a wild-type mouse that's not a model for autism, can we make it autistic, more autistic-like, I should say, by also targeting that receptor in the opposite direction? And the answer was, yes, they could. So a converging line of evidence from rodent work around the GABA-A receptor and potentially some particular subtypes, the alpha 2 and 3. So you're all very sensible people. You'll realize that, you know, a rat is not a human, and a rat is not autistic. A rat has autistic-like behaviors, and a mouse has autistic-like behaviors. What then is going on in the human? Is there anything that gives us some provisional backing to this as a model? Now, the next slide I'm about to show you, and the one after that, I want you to take as extremely preliminary. I'm absolutely not saying that this is incontrovertible evidence, that we are finding supportive evidence. This is preliminary evidence which needs replicating, and in the second slide I'm going to show you more particularly needs publishing. So what happens when we look in humans? We find from this work by Jamie Horder in a very small pilot study in the GABA-A receptor a significant reduction, which is a similar finding to that found in the rodent. That obviously is very pilot. So what Jamie has done together under the umbrella of EU AIMS, he's worked together with our colleagues in the Karolinska Institute to carry out two PET studies, one based in London and one based in Stockholm. And both studies are looking at the GABA-A receptor, but in a slightly different way. Now that data is in the middle of being analyzed. But like a cookery program, you know, here's one I baked earlier. I'm now going to show you some extremely preliminary data that Jackie Borg very kindly sent me yesterday from the Karolinska, just to show you what they're finding. And Jackie's findings, together with Krista and Lars, of course, are very promising. They are finding significant relationships within individuals with autism to GABA-A receptor binding and degrees of cognitive flexibility. But I stress to you, this is preliminary work. We've just started doing the analysis. This has not been submitted yet to a peer-reviewed journal. I'm just showing you this in the spirit of openness because we're a publicly funded group. And just to show you that there's some potential human data that might be supporting the rodent data. So where have we got to now in this talk? I've agreed with you, I hope, that we're talking about a highly genetic disorder with environmental influences, that that's associated with differences in brain development and connectivity, that we think that we've got candidate neural systems that have been identified, and some potential final common pathways have been identified. And one, but only one, of many of the ways forward might be GABA-A. For those of you who don't know, that's the elephant in the room. So I've hopefully G'd you up and made you think, flipping heck, we're about to make a major discovery and we're about to have a fantastic treatment that works. But this elephant in the room in England means the kind of things that you're never really allowed to discuss. But because I'm with a few thousand close friends, and I know you won't tell anybody else this, I decided that I'd also share with you some of the problems it is that we've encountered along the way. So here's our model. Do you remember the model that we're working from? Here we have all these genes. They work along these pathways. They impact on your biological pathways. They then go to brain region circuits. And then you've got autism. I mean, you've got to love it, right? Pretty convincing. But how simplistic? Because it assumes a unidirection of flow. And we know, for example, that those different genetic variants, the same genetic variant will have different influences in different brain regions across the developmental cycle and across different ages. So we're not talking about a one hit, that's it. We're talking about a one hit that continues to modify how it affects you throughout your life. We also know that this excitation inhibition balance thing is a little bit more tricky than I told you, because it all depends upon which age you are. And there's some evidence that actually the role of GABA may vary depending upon your developmental age. We also know that it's not as simple as one size fits all, one brain region does one thing. A brain region's function is a function of age. And so brain regions which at the moment may underpin some key cognitive domain, in a few years' time, they may not be as involved. And last but not least, we know that things like maternal rearing and interactions also affect our genome and the methylation of our genome. So it's a two-way process. It's not a simple binary process. That's the easy stuff. We then have the other stuff. I'm going to assume that one of you in the audience one day is going to be that genius that finds the pathology of autism. Okay? I'm waiting for that paper. And I'm going to show you now pathology and why we need to be careful around another abnormal social behavior. And this is the Dan Geschwin Matt State disorder. And what we're saying here is that these two individuals, lovely, lovely people, but they have this bunch of researchers who've been misbehaving. And they say, why are they misbehaving? What are we going to do? So we think, well, we'd better go in there and behaviorally phenotype those badly behaving researchers that work for Dan and Matt. So here we go. Here's the first one. So we think, oh, well, doesn't look like a great researcher to me. I don't know about you, but works in Dan's lab. Then we bring the next one in. Goodness me. I'm beginning to spot a pathology that's associated with abnormal behaviors and working in Dan's lab. Goodness me. I've now got three individuals with the same behavioral phenotype who've got the same pathology. I'm going to do a genetic study on them, and I'm going to find out that it's strongly associated with being born in Southern California and having high parental age. We're then going to come along, and we're going to say, I think that might be associated in a key biological mechanism, which is the black eye. This pathology in this disorder is the black eye. And so we do lots and lots and lots of really fantastic experiments, and we work out things like these people have got a clotting disorder around their eye. They've got bruising around their eye. So we come up with a treatment that targets the bruising around the eye. Who thinks that treatment will work? Right, it's not going to work, is it? Because the guy on the top left has got a black eye because he's been drinking. The guy in the middle has got a black eye because he's been dancing and he fell over. And the only sensible person in this picture, which of course is the woman, has got the black eye because she's been bashing her head against the wall because it's so difficult working with these male colleagues. Right? So we have a clear behavioral phenotype with a pathology that's got nothing to do with a disorder. So you have to ask yourself, just because you find a pathology, is it actually linked to what you're finding? We now have another pathology, just to show that I'm fair. This is, again, to do with unusual social behaviors. And in this particular example, this is the Murphy phenotype. And it's associated with not being able to look people in the eye properly. Now, why is that? The answer, hopefully, when you look at this slide, is obvious. There's my dizygotic twin, who's more high-achieving, obviously, in the sense of in a way we want to be. But we've decided we need help. We're going to go and see a behavioral person. And they told us, well, okay, Declan, here's what you need to do. You need to practice jumping up and down so that you can look people in the eye. So here we go. We go through our behavioral training. And here I am. We're hopping up and down. We've got a set of eyeballs on the top of those shelves. And I'm telling you, it was exhausting. But We've made some inroads into my appalling behavior. Now, if you see me at a reception, you'll see me hopping up and down, and I'm able to look into your eyes. But that's really not going to generalize. We need a simpler treatment than that. Let's think of the ladder treatment. Let's give me that treatment. What happens? Oh, that was easy. Up I came. We've now got a biological intervention, low cost, low effort. I'm now looking at people right in the eyes. Right? Murphy disorder cured. Everyone agree? Right. But now we give it to the other part of the phenotype. Let's make him go up the ladder. Still not looking people in the eyes because you've given him the same ladder. What you should have done was given him a smaller ladder. So what you really need to do then, what I'm saying in a more complicated way now, is you need to fractionate that clinical phenotype and you need to design your intervention on a much more individual basis so that your target is much more exact to those affected subtypes of individuals. How can we begin to do that? And are we able to begin to do that? Well, I think we are on the way to doing that. I don't think that we are there by any means. But we have proof of concept when we use brain imaging that we may be able to differentiate cases from controls and cases from other individuals with neurodevelopmental disorders with relatively high accuracies. And that was work of Christine Eckers, based upon all her colleagues who came before, including the work, of course, of Christine Nordahl. So we think that imaging may be one way to help us fractionate the phenotype. It's not going to be the only way, nor will it work in the same way in all individuals at all different time points in their lives. No biomarker will. As a group of researchers, we have to get used to the concept that the use of your biomarker will depend upon the age at which you're working with the individuals. So, for example, if we use Amir Klin's early work that's recently been published around infants, if we look at Sally Ozanov's work also around young infants, and if we look at Joe Piven's group's work also around infants, using different kinds of biomarkers and relating those to the behavioral phenotype. You could see how each of those would discriminate between cases and controls really well at one particular age, but would not discriminate so well at another age because you're asking it to do a different thing. So what we need is biomarkers which help us diagnose individuals at different ages, but we also need biomarkers which will move with the phenotype and which we know may predict change in that phenotype as opposed to following on from change in that phenotype. The other things that we do is that we tend to work in isolation. So we've gone from the science and we're now going on to our scientific culture. The way that we tend to work in science is that you have fantastic research, for example, being carried out in genetics or in neuroimaging or in molecular biology, whatever it is. But these groups of individuals tend to work in pods. It's relatively rare to have work which truly moves from the bench to the bedside or from the bedside back to the bench. And what does that mean? It means that because we've got so little crosstalk, we often don't see the wood for the trees. And now I'm going to give you an example, a bit of a silly example, but I'll give you an example nonetheless. This is the kind of thing that my colleagues in molecular biology love. Now, you're sensible people. You'll probably be appalled by this slide. And you'll think, how on earth could a person work with that kind of thing? But molecular biologists, this is what they do. And when I was talking to you earlier in the day about GABA-A, for example, if you look at that slide, you'll see there are multiplicities of influences upon GABA-A in terms of how it develops, multiplicities of interactions of GABA-A with other receptor subtypes, but also different final pathways, final common pathways that might be implicated. So what we would tend to do, say, in GABA-A, just as an example, we'd be focusing only on what does GABA A do. And an example of a lost opportunity is this. Let's just assume that within the United Kingdom, we've been brave enough to invite one of the appalling examples from Dan's lab, and they've come to London. We know they're going to want to drink. And so we've got to get the drink to them. And the drink comes through the GABA-A receptor. It comes from the airport in France to the airport in London, and then it's taken by a truck, and it goes out and it's delivered, right? So currently, the GABA-A person would be thinking, man, that loop's not working. I need to look really closely at the airport in Paris, or the wheels on the jumbo, or the wings on the jumbo, or the way that jumbo's landing, or what's going on at Heathrow, or how is it getting the stuff off the plane onto that truck, right? That's what the GABA-A person working in isolation would think. But there's another way to think, and that's, well, hang on, we just want to get there. And maybe there's a slower way to do it that also gives us the end product we want. Maybe there's also a faster alternative way that we could get to it that also gives us the outcome that we want. So what I've said to you is we need to think of alternative ways of thinking, not just think the narrow molecular route alone, think how can we get around that route? What's an alternative way forward? And an alternative way forward in the last slide which I showed you was to stop the person drinking. That would be a good behavioral thing. But to do that, we need to work with affected individuals. And what do affected individuals think about us? And this is an example, which I've shown you now, about what some of the general public and some religious bodies think about people who work in psychiatry, a museum of death. So difficult to persuade some individuals to work with psychiatrists. It's also difficult to persuade some people with autism who have incredible talents that, you know what, I'm going to design a treatment which is going to reduce special interests. Because if I have a special interest in a particular talent, why would I want you to be taking it away? So what we need to do is to really engage with the public and with affected individuals to understand what is it that you want to achieve from the treatments that we're trying to deliver to you? And how is it that we can work with you to understand whether this treatment is working or not, or giving you benefit? So how are we going to do that? How do we move the field forward? I say we move the field forward. We need to better understand the mechanisms underpinning autism. We need to take multidisciplinary approaches. We need to link the laboratory work to the clinic. And we need stratification tools which adapt and change, our use of them changes depending upon the question we ask. And lastly, we need to engage with individuals and regulators. So where are we at? I'm firstly going to very briefly chat to you about where you've got to in America, and I think you know, you've really made terrific progress very recently. And then I'm going to be talking about the sorts of things that we're doing within Europe. Well, within the USA, you've now got the FAST-FAIL Autism Spectrum Disorder Trials Program. That's led by Jim McCracken in collaboration with his colleagues at Emory and at MGH and at University of Washington. They're having a panel later on, so I urge you to go to that panel. And what they've done, which is highly innovative, is that they're working together with ANCATS to select compounds in collaboration with industry and other regulatory authorities. And they're also using a medicinal medicine approach, so they are using biomarkers. And in this particular example, they're going to be looking at the utility of electrophysiology to fractionate their sample. So really innovative first step along the way. What are we doing within Europe? Well, within Europe, we have a thing called the Innovative Medicines Initiative. And that's a joint venture between the governments, academia, and industry, with a 2 billion euro budget put in from both sources. With the idea being that Europe has said, we want to be a knowledge-based economy. We think that healthcare is a critical part of our economy, and we want to be in that space. And to do that, we need to have public-private partnerships, which have all those issues which normally stop progress solved, for example, IP issues, but which also work very closely with our colleagues in the third sector and representatives of people who are affected. So we're very fortunate to be funded for our network, and we're a network which spans Europe. We are a number of collaborating centers with expertise in basic science through to clinical sciences. And importantly, and a very public vote of thank you very much to Autism Speaks, who contributed to help us develop a biomarker base and a biobank for all the things that we're going to be collecting up. So what's our approach? Our approach is this, is we've said, in order to make progress on the far right-hand side of this triangle that you can see, clinical research, we absolutely have to have it linked up to cellular assays, in other words, stem cell work, animal models, and then translate that into real, breathing, living human beings. So what progress have we made, and where are we at? And I'm going to give you a couple of examples, just of the broad philosophy of what we're doing. I'll then give you two concrete examples of work that we've, three concrete examples, I should say, I'm sorry, of work that we've published. And then the next five or six or so slides will be unpublished work, which again, I'm just showing you for the sake of openness, but with the caveat that this has not been submitted yet to peer-reviewed journals, and you must therefore take it with a pinch of salt. So where are we at and what's our philosophy? Our philosophy is that we think that we can make significant progress by firstly working with individuals who've got known CNVs. And so, for example, if you look at the top of this slide here, you'll see there's a country called Iceland. I don't know if you're aware, but the whole of Iceland has been genotyped. And there's a company there called Decode that holds that information. We then work with Decode to deep phenotype using imaging and behavioral measures all the individuals with a particular genetic variant that we find of interest. We deep phenotype that individual, and then we say, how similar or dissimilar is that to someone we know who's got a non-syndromic form of autism? And we then say, can we relate that finding back to a rodent model? And if we can we grow new stems, grow new cells, so we can see if we can modify the development of those cells, and then back up again into the human? So what progress have we made so far? We've demonstrated that the age of father is a risk factor for having mutations which are associated with autism. We've also worked together with colleagues in NewMed, which is another IMI initiative, to say, what happens if we look at these CNVs which are also affected in psychosis? What's the effect there? And we find significant association between variation in the healthy Icelandic population between this particular genetic variant on 15q11 and brain anatomy. And the next step now, of course, is to say, how does that modify risk for developing psychosis and or autism? How do we take that into the clinical populations? We do that in two clinical cohorts. The first, which is led by Mark Johnson and his colleagues at Birkbeck, who link out to colleagues across Europe, including at the Karolinska, etc. And what they're looking at is 300 high-risk infants, 100 low-risk infants, aged between 3 to 7 months. And they are trying to identify biomarkers that can be used across a number of centers and which precede onset of clinical symptomatology. So, for example, it's not good enough for me to say, I think I've got a terrific biomarker for risk for autism, which is, say, imaging, or, say, NIRS, or eye tracking, what you really want to know is, if I'm a center that's only got eye tracking, how does my data map onto your data? What's the biological basis for that, and can I begin to work out that? So Mark and colleagues are doing that. They're bringing a number of technologies together to understand the biological underpinnings of that and how they relate to each other. That's closely linked to another study, which is of children of 6 years and over, in which we're following up 450 affected individuals, 100 of whom are low functioning, and 350 controls. We're following them up for between 18 to 24 months, again, measuring the efficacy of the biomarkers at time one, seeing how they change over time, and to see whether this precedes or predicts change in clinical symptomatology. But okay, I hear you scream. Okay, how's that really going to take us forward? And how are we going to relate that back to rodent models? Well, I'm going to give you one example, and it's only one example of how we're doing that. We are taking a rodent model, which we think has got both construct and face validity. We're going to try and identify the cellular and functional alterations at synapses in that rodent model. And we're then going to see if we can recapitulate that abnormality in the human who's got idiopathic autism. And then we're going to see, can we modify that with a pharmacological intervention? So as one example, this is rodent work carried out by Peter Scheifler in Basel, in which they've been working with the neuroligin 3 mutant mouse, because it has good face validity and construct validity for being a model for some autistic behaviors. It also is associated with specific abnormalities that we're interested in within the EI balance system. And so what Peter did as part of EU AIMS is to ask the first question is, do these rodents who are a model for autism, do they have a similar abnormality to another rodent model for syndromic autism? And what Peter found was, well, yes, they've got a very similar abnormality. In this particular example, it's mGluR1 expression. He also reported an increase in ectopic synapse formation, reduced glutamatergic transmission, and he found that in that genetic model, he was able to rescue it by genetic re-expression of neuroligin 3. Now, I know that you're probably beginning to think, you know, what's that guy been smoking? There's absolutely no way we're going to change the genome of a person with an autistic spectrum disorder. You're not going to be rescuing their genotype. What can you do with a pharmacological probe? So what Peter did was he worked with colleagues of ours who are in industry, in Janssen, and he said, have you got any tool compounds which were around which you think might help? This is unpublished data, and this is the first results showing that we think there's pilot evidence suggesting that that phenotype, that cellular phenotype, can be rescued using a pharmacologic approach. We then go on and we say, well, okay, that's a rodent. How are we going to get that into a human conceptually? Now, you can do that in a number of ways. You could use electrophysiology. You could use behavioral. But in this example, we're going to use a type of brain imaging called MR spectroscopy, because we can use that to get a measure of glutamate and GABA. I should say we are also looking at the functional and structural differences, but the data I'm going to show you today is simply around the MR spectroscopy. So this is work from a great colleague of ours called Maria, who works in Roche. And what she found was that in this same rodent model, with differences in glutamatergic expression and reduced glutamatergic activity at the synapse, she found using spectroscopy in this particular example within striatum, that she found that rodent had a significant reduction in the overall glutamate concentration. And why is that of interest? I hear you scream. Should I really keep dozing? Should I wake up at this bit? Try and wake up a little bit, because we find the same thing in human. when we look within idiopathic individuals with autism, we also find within basal ganglia a significant reduction in overall glutamate-glutamine signal. Now, as a confession, this was carried out at 1.5 tesla. And for those of you who are brain imagers, you'll start tittering. And for those of you who aren't brain imagers, you'll know that all we do is talk about the size of our machines. And this particular machine is like, what's the worst car in America? I don't know, it's like a Chevy or something? I don't know. I'm only joking because I know Joe's got one. So this would be like a Ford T then of brain imaging. What happens if we do that thing which you're always supposed to do but you never do, which is to try and replicate your own work? And using a higher scanner, what we found was we actually replicate that. So we take it into the human, we find the finding, we then replicate it with a higher spectroscopy machine, and we also find a relationship to behavior. And so then what Jamie and Andrina did was they said, well, that's okay, but that's not really all the way, is it? Because you then want to understand, well, what's the link between that and behavior? How could it be explaining the difference in behavior? And so what Jamie and Andrina did was they said, well, why don't we look at the relationship between those differences in glutamate and your functional brain connectivity? And so what Jamie's finding is that those differences in brain glutamate are significantly related to differences in brain functional connectivity, and particularly between basal ganglia and frontal regions and basal ganglia and other limbic regions. So, not enough, I hear you scream. Again, this is all pilot data, I stress. That's still not enough, because what we need to do now is we need to say, how can we come up with something that people who don't have imaging can be using in trials as a proxy measure for what we're finding? So let's see if we can find a relationship between that level in the brain of glutamate and that EI balance and your electrophysiologic reactivity during completion of a go, no-go task. The reason why one of the reasons why we chose that is that we're finding Francesca Happe, together with Ellie Wilson, are just about to publish results of a cognitive phenotyping study in which they're finding very robust differences between cases and controls in terms of executive function. And so what we're saying is that during those differences in executive function, we are finding differences in electrophysiologic response, and that those differences in electrophysiologic response are associated with variation in your EI balance. So that's fine, isn't it? I've sort of done lots of basic sciencey stuff and tried to show how we'll get that into the clinic. But what David Mandel and others would say, and Tony Chalmers would say, well, you know, there's a lot of steps you've got to go through yet to actually get something around this in the clinic. How do we do that? How do you get these things into the clinic? Part of that is science, but another part of it is working with the regulatory authorities to say, what would you accept as a trial outcome marker? So there's no good me saying, I've got this fantastic thing found by Jamie and Andrina, which relates to electrophysiology. We're now going to see if treatment affects it. What you want is the FDA or the European Medicines Agency to say, well, actually, you know what? We accept from the beginning of your trial that as an outcome marker. So that's what we're doing. We're working very hard. We all went to meet the European Medicines Agency, a team led by Jan Butelaar and Tony Charman. And they are going to be giving us advice on the utility or not of the biomarkers which we're proposing and the cognitive behavioral markers that we're proposing. And we should hear within the next 2 weeks what their advice will be as to which of these we would be able to use. But that still isn't enough. Say the EMA give us the go-ahead in terms of the way we're thinking. We then need to have clinical trials to take that into real affected people. And this work is led by Tony Charman, so very, very big thanks to Tony for leading on this. And what Tony and his colleagues have done is they've managed to identify 34 sites from across the EU who are going to be willing to become part of a clinical trials network. And that would then involve Tony and colleagues training them up to standard so that if and when we have a new compound that will be coming through or a new intervention, a behavioral or educational intervention that's coming through, we would then have people who are trained and ready to rock and roll and ready to go. So, this is the last two slides, I promise you. Where have we got to and what have I told you today? Why have treatment trials so far, at least in terms of the pharmacologic treatments, why haven't we done too well? Well, we've done not so well because the biology is complex, number one, and we don't have that good an understanding of the biologies. And so one option is that our therapeutic targets might have been incorrect. Another equally compelling argument might be we had the right biological targets, but we gave everybody the same treatment. What we then need to do is to work out which individuals would best map onto those individualized treatment approaches. The other reasons why we've had difficulties making progress is that we have relied on subjective, self or observer-based reports that are inaccurate and hard to replicate. And we don't have objective clinical outcome measures that actually relate to the underlying pathophysiology of what we think is wrong. Last but not least, as you saw at the beginning of my talk, we really do not have trials of the size which we've had in other disorders. We've had multiple brief, relatively small-scale, me too trials, by which I mean all asking a similar-ish sort of question. And I want to stress here, before I come on to the last point, is the brief bit. If we think that we have a lifelong neurodevelopmental disorder, and we have someone coming into our trial who has been autistic for, let's call it 9 years, or let's call it 9 years, how likely is it, do you think, a priori, that they will respond to a 6-week or 8-week intervention? Not that likely. But that is actually the way that a lot of our clinical trials go. So we need to be braver, and we need to have a mixed model in which we are carrying out longer-term interventions, be they educational, be they behavioral, or be they pharmacologic. But most importantly, it cannot be carried out in pods which are isolated from each other. They have to relate to ongoing basic science, whether that's the cognitive neurosciences, whether that's new educational sciences or pharmacotherapy sciences. But they have to link up. And they have to be able to adapt to new data as it emerges. So for example, if we have an adaptive trial design, currently in a trial, you'd treat 100 people, you'd give them all the same medicine, you know from the get-go, most of them aren't going to respond. But we can learn an awful lot by taking those non-responders and asking why don't they respond? And are there alternative treatments we can target at those individuals, either alone or in combination? So what's my suggested way forward? As you'd expect, I think we've absolutely got to explicitly link clinical trials to ongoing basic research. We have to have adaptive trial designs which respond to emerging data. We have to use biomarkers and other, perhaps cognitive batteries, to come up with cohorts of individuals who are more biologically or cognitively homogeneous so that we can use much more individualized medicines approach. We need those objective outcome markers. We need to be involving affected individuals and their families in our target choice and in our trial design. We need to be involving regulators and industry in target identification and in development of our biomarkers. And we need very large-scale studies which are underpinned by a long-term vision. Now, you'll no doubt be looking at me thinking, blimmin' heck, that's a lot from a small guy. How on earth can we do that? That's gonna billions. Well, it's not, because we can make very real progress now just by aligning better our international efforts. So that's one step in terms of, say, sharing of databases and standard operating procedures for the trials that we do. Also relating to our ongoing trials, but we will need large-scale multinational efforts for these trials. For those of you who could bear to read more about this, I'd refer you to a paper that written by myself and Will, which describes EU aims in more detail. If you've got anything wonderful that you want to say, please feel free to email me. If you've got anything appalling that you want to say, please email Will. He's on the top. And with that, I would like to thank you very much and thank you for your attention.